Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hello, good evening everybody. It's great to be here on such a sunny day. I'm really hoping that the internet doesn't die of heat exhaustion like it's been doing to me all day, but I am thrilled to be here tonight on Wild Ginger Running with coach and physio Tim Piggott from HP3. Hello Tim.
Hi, good to see you again.
Tim is a friend of the channel. He's done various gear reviews for us and training advice, and we've interviewed him in the past as well. So I will put links to his previous films in the description below. So if you want to hear more from Tim, then just click on the show notes or the film description below. So I'll just fill you in why we're talking to Tim tonight. So he's just won the Summer Spine Challenger, which is 110 miles along the Pennine Way. Big round of applause. Congratulations. And the reason that this is such an incredible, it's incredible anyway, this achievement, but it makes it even more special because when Tim was 20, which I'm not sure how long ago that is, I'm sure he'll fill us in, he was in a car crash that broke bones. It left him on life support for 5 days. He had multiple operations and he was told at one point that he may never run again. And then he managed to come back from that a while ago, and he won first place in 23 hours 3 minutes and 22 seconds, the time on the watch. Not sure what the official time is yet, but I'm sure he'll fill us in later, which is 50 minutes off the course record. So congratulations Tim, how did it make you feel crossing that finish line with everything you've come through?
Yeah, that was a very special race, and it was just essentially the perfect race. Everything had just gone as I would have wanted during that day and night, obviously. The build-up hadn't been perfect. I'd been ill sort of a couple of weeks beforehand, but everything just came good on the day. And you know, you just couldn't better that experience. Running, knowing that the course record was within my grasp unless something horrendous had gone wrong. And I didn't quite know where the other Tim, who was in second place, was, but I was fairly confident in those last few miles that the win was also there. So yeah, just a really, really special day. I mean, the spine, obviously the full spine is legendary, but even the Challenger is a very well-respected race in itself. So it was a race that I'd sort of mulled the idea of, could I actually win this? Is that actually within my grasp? And it was something that had been discussed between myself and some friends so a good year or so prior. And it was put down, I was like, yeah, this is doable. But of course, it's how everything comes together. And it was one of those just perfect days.
Yeah, and it was so well deserved as well after everything you've been through. And I read your blog, you've done a really extensive blog about this, which you can find on HP3 coaching website. If you just click on the resources section and then the blog section, it's a couple of posts down. So on reading your blog, it was very clear, as you said, that you've done a lot of prep for this race. So you've done like recceing, you did pace testing on those recces, you did shoe testing, you did a whole another 100 miler just to check you could run 100 miles, did fuel testing, you did gear, you did like lightweight gear, and you put it all in a spreadsheet and you weighed it all, etc. Yeah. It sounds insane.
Oh, geeky.
Yeah, you totally geeked out on that. You watched videos of the Pennine Way, you spoke to past runners, including Tom Hollins, who you coach. Tom Hollins has won the winter Spine Race before, hasn't he?
That's right,
So you spoke to him as well. And the challenger. Amazing athlete. I just was wondering, as I was reading all that, I was like, as a mum myself, and I know you're a dad to two young children, and you've got like HP3 coaching and physioing and everything, how on earth did you make time for that with having two kids and a full-time job?
I don't have a social life.
You watch zero Netflix for you.
Yeah, pretty much. It's one of those where I wrote that blog and really try to explain how, you know, I am just your average runner. I'm not some elite athlete to be put on a pedestal. I'm just like everybody else out there. So all the people that are watching your show right now, you know, I've been like you and I am like you. There's nothing special about me. But what I hope to show is that, you know, if you set yourself a huge target like that, and I set myself a target of, you know, I want to try and win this, and I think even breaking the course record is within my grasp. But that was still a huge task. But if you break it down and you work through all those different processes, anything is possible. So that's why I wanted to kind of write that blog in that way. So just showing all the different processes you work towards. But this was a long build. This was the race was entered last year. It was sort of September I entered it. But even prior to that, I'd already been, I mean, I live almost on the Pennine Way anyway, so I know sections of the course, but I've been running up and down the Pennine Way thinking, okay, you know, in a year or two, I'm going to race this, you know, what would it be like? So it's been a long, long build up. I mean, you mentioned I'd run 100 miles in preparation. That's not a normal training program to go and run 100 miles as part of a 100 mile training program. It just happened to be I did another race in January, the Lady Anne Way, advertised at 100 miles, but actually it was 98 miles, but let's not worry about that.
Well, you probably meandered a bit. There was probably a bit of walking to register and all that.
Yeah.
You had to walk back to the car at the end.
There was no walking at the end of that one. But I did that one, as you say, just to see if I could run 100 miles, because actually in September I DNF'd another 100. I DNF'd at Ultra Tour Monte Rosa. I DNF'd at mile 86. So I needed to kind of get over that DNF and just have a successful finish. And I tested a lot of my ideas around, you know, how to do well at 100. And, you know, the main thing that really stood out was you've got to recce it. You've got to know every little twist and turn of that course. And that's what I did for the spine. And, you know, talking to others and reading other people's race reports afterwards, you know, the things that maybe didn't go quite so well for them, I think largely was down to just not knowing the course and making those little errors. I mean, I hold my hand up, myself and Andy, we were chatting away at one point and we did actually miss a turn and we went a couple of metres the wrong way, but we quickly realised that was us just chatting away too much and not paying attention to the race.
I'm just glad that you had like the breath and the energy to chat. I think that makes miles just go like that, doesn't it, when you're chatting to someone?
Yeah. Again, you know, saying it was one of those just perfect days, but it was a run in the hills with mates. I was running with Andy Morley, who I coach as well. It was, you know, he's a mate, and we ran a good section of the race together. I had Joe Horn as well, who was with us for the first section, and you know, Ian Cox as well. So we had, you know, good mates and part of the Team HP3 athletes. But it was a run of the hills with mates, and then I kind of got antisocial and pulled the head.
And you forgoed a bacon butty whilst your teammate had a bacon butty. I thought that was funny.
In a sort of tactical decision.
Yeah, the tactical bacon butty.
Having solid food at that point.
Yeah.
Whereas Andy did decide to go for the solid food option. But you know, we know from practice that he can handle solid food better. I know from practice that I don't handle solid food as well. So although I'd paid for my bacon butty, I decided not to eat it.
Yeah, good move. It's a good move. And I just want to let you know that we have actually got somebody else who did the Spine Challenger watching. Interviewed Hannah Basley. I interviewed her last month. She's a mum of two as well, two girls. And she said... she's here tonight and she says, "Evening, I was almost at the opposite end of the Challenger field to Tim. Amazing result." I think anyone who completes it is an absolute legend.
Absolutely. There's not many people out there that can run over 100 miles.
Yeah, it's just amazing, crazy distance. And Hannah's got a question that we'll ask you later on about nutrition. And I just wanted to just say that Lloyd wanted to say something as well. Lloyd Watkin, one of my patrons, he said he's got his first 100 mile on Saturday. So he's going to find this really interesting to find out all the things he's done wrong in the lead up. So a little bit late for poor Lloyd, but I believe you do have to do one in training for your real one where you're going to break the course record, Lloyd. So it's just all training, don't worry. We've also got Andrea watching. She says hello, Tim and Claire, and David Alonso from Quebec. If you're watching live, then do type in the chat box and ask Tim any questions, and just send a general shout out if you're enjoying the show. I just wanted to start off. I'll just go through things in the same way that you did in your blog, if that's okay, because it seemed like your logical way of like approaching things. Like, I noticed that training came quite far down. Like, first you sorted out all your gear and your nutrition and stuff, and I thought that was really interesting. So first of all, you had to find the right shoe. So how important is the right shoe on 100 milers? I'm guessing very.
I mean, my wife thinks I have a problem when it comes to shoes.
You should see behind me. I've got 14 pairs of shoes.
I think this is a problem that many of us can relate to, isn't it? In terms of our maybe obsession with buying shoes.
But you know what? I still haven't found the perfect one. The perfect trail shoe. It's a hybrid of like a couple of shoes or three shoes that I want. I think that custom shoes need to happen.
And I think, you know, there are some sort of, Solomon certainly had their custom shoe option a while back. I'm not sure if that's still going.
Yeah, I haven't heard much about it.
No, it was a little while ago. But yeah, I mean, trying to find the right shoe. It's finding something for the right terrain. That's the really tricky thing. And obviously what's going to be comfortable for you. So when it comes to finding the right footwear, I mean, we've talked about this on other kind of reviews and things like that. But when it comes to the sort of technology and some of the stuff that the marketing companies throw at you, you know, motion control, stability, you know, these type of things, the main thing is, when you put the shoe on, is it comfortable? That's really what matters. And not worrying about whether it's maybe minimalist or maximalist or all this type of stuff. It depends on what's right for your foot. So you just need to try things on and see what works for you. In terms of finding the right shoe for this race, the Spine has a little bit of almost everything on it. In terms of, it's got some sort of quite rough technical trail, certainly at the beginning. You've got running over the slabs, the paving slabs. You've got boggy sections of moorland. You've got running through fields. You've got little bits of road as well. So you've got basically a bit of everything. So I needed a shoe that was going to be cushioned enough for the hard stuff, but give me enough grip and stability on the technical. Ended up trialing some Scarpa shoes. And basically tried on their one of their brand new ones, the Kima, Golden Gate Kimas, and it was just the perfect shoe for me. Good bit of cushioning, nice wide toe box, good rubber compound for good grip. Yeah, it's their kind of top end. It's got the carbon plate for a bit of extra bounce. Spring in it. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's an absolutely brilliant pair of shoes.
Cool.
I tested that in different runs. I've done a run in the legs. I did legs 1, 2, and 3 of the Bob Graham when I was supporting Jo Meek on her Bob Graham round. I don't know if you've interviewed her yet. You should do that.
I've definitely spoken to her in the past. I've interviewed her for Trail Running Magazine, that's for sure. I know her, and I saw her at the UTMB 2019 as well. But it'd be lovely to interview her.
But yeah, so, you know, I put the shoes to the paces. I did a good sort of 100-150 miles and then knew they were going to be good. And they did, you know, they absolutely did the job. So it's about you've got to find what's going to work for you. You know, some people like less cushioning, more ground feel. I need a bit more cushioning because I haven't got that spring and shock absorbance in my legs because they're full of metal. So I need those more cushioned shoes. But obviously, if you go too cushioned, you sometimes lose stability on the technical ground. Whereas these, the Scarpa Kimas are a little bit more lower to the ground, so you've got better stability, but you've still got some really good cushioning. So yeah, they were a fantastic pair of shoes.
Cool. I'll have to check them out. I've got a pair of their Golden Gate ATRs.
And
I found them too stiff and very cushioned. I can't feel anything underfoot. So I think the Kimas sound a lot better for trail running. They're supposed to be like a road to trail shoe. So
they are. I've got a pair as well.
I feel like they're more roady.
They are very much your kind of beginner road onto a little bit of trail. So I've got a pair of those for when I'm running down the roads onto maybe the canal.
Canal path.
And I'm just doing long, easy runs on that. And I just want a bit of extra cushioning because my feet are battered from something else.
Yeah, well, we should talk about why you need, you know, a bit of extra support and, like, your lack of tendons in your ankles. So I think this is a really good point to, like, mention what happened with the car crash and how it beat you up and when it was and how long it took you to get back from it.
So, yeah, you were saying that you didn't know quite how many years ago it was. So,
you're clearly only 21 now, but it can't have been last year.
I wish. I've just had another birthday, so I'm now 42. Although, as you can maybe tell from my voice, I'm a little bit croaky because I've got COVID at the moment.
Oh, no.
So I'm skipping this birthday. I don't think the last birthday counted. But yes, that was 22 years ago. So I'm 42 now. And yeah, as you kind of said at the beginning there, I was driving on a straight old Roman road, going to the top of a blind summit, and another car on the wrong side of the road and took me out.
That is just so, like, tragic, isn't it? Well, not tragic, because you're here to tell the tale, but, like, why do people do that? It just made me so annoyed when I read that on your blog.
Yeah, you know, the young guy's just lapse of concentration, and that lapse of concentration had severe consequences.
Yeah.
30 seconds either way would have got away with it, but anyway.
Yeah.
So I broke my left tib and fib, so my lower leg, broke my right femur, so my right thigh, smashed my pelvis into multiple pieces, right hemi-C for anybody medical. I broke various ribs, broke my wrist, my radius, dislocated my wrist as well. I degloved my elbow, so ripped all the flesh off my elbow, and broke my jaw. So all sort of fairly major fractures.
Looking at you, you wouldn't even know. Like, there doesn't seem to be any visible anything on you.
I've got a little scar there. But that's why I wobble when I walk. I limp when I walk.
I haven't noticed that either. So unobservant.
Of me, I'm off to one side. The car was an utter mess. So, you know, you hear about the kind of golden hour to get somebody into hospital.
Yeah.
It took them 2 hours to actually cut me out of the car.
Get
to hospital. But the initial emergency surgery kind of put me vaguely back into one piece again. But the problem with that much trauma is obviously there's a lot of bleeding, internal bleeding.
Yeah.
I didn't have any real external wounds, so all that blood basically just filled up my cavities, and then ended up sort of filling my lungs with fluid. So I ended up with what's called ARDS, acute respiratory distress syndrome. So that's what put me on life support for 5 days.
Yeah.
And back then, it was something that really wasn't survivable.
Oh,
God. And the hospital I was in didn't really have the resources. But thankfully, I came through. I mean, I was very, very fit at the time. And it was quite clearly that level of fitness that I had and that got me through.
Do you mind if I just put a picture up of your blog? Yeah. I've just taken a picture from your blog of you in that hospital bed and the car. Like, do you get any sort of, like, emotionally, is it a difficult thing to talk about, or are you just like super happy that you actually survived? I'm just showing the picture of you wired up in all the bed, and then the car, which is just completely, that you can vaguely work out that it's a car, but it's just really crumpled at the front there. Thank goodness
see
for crumple zones. not sure.
I don't get overly emotional about it. This far down the line, it was almost like a movie I saw once upon a time. It's I'm quite good at compartmentalising it, or
that happened. I'm alive still.
But it was the sort of training that I had at the time. It was quite simply a case of, you know, once I was aware enough to know what was happening, it was a case of, right, what do we need to do to get on with it? And it was always a case of looking forward, not looking back. We all have down days, we all have blue days, and feel sorry for ourselves, but, you know, on the whole, it's look forward. And again, it was just that attitude right from the get-go, which was always look forward, you know, push forward. And that's, I think, again, what got me through and got me out into the kind of rehab that then resulted in this. And it's that, again, the training that I've had, that you just don't give up.
Did they say at first, so first of all, they didn't think you were going to actually live, and then did it become you might not walk again, and then did it become you might not run again? Was it like that, or how did it go?
No, it was, when I first came round from the accident itself, so I was knocked unconscious, obviously, initially, but then came round fairly quickly. And I had, so I was in the reserves, the TA at the time, so I had sort of reasonable combat medic knowledge, and I did a quick self-assessment and realized I was in a very, very, very poor state, and I needed more than just a paramedic to keep me alive, and I was about 10 minutes from where my parents were, or my parents are, which was where I was at the time. And my dad's a doctor, or he was a doctor, he's retired now. But he used to do the emergency cover for equestrian events. And I knew that in the back of his car was full resus equipment.
Wow.
So I got the chat to the person who pulled up behind the accident to actually phone my dad, but just say, there's a car crash up the road, bring all your kit. So he rocks up, not even knowing it's me.
Oh my God. And you had the presence of mind to not tell him it was you, so that he wouldn't speed on the way and get into an accident himself.
But then it was a case of, obviously it was taking a long time to cut me out, and it was a case of, this probably isn't going to go the right way. So I was actually giving my dad messages to pass on to people.
Oh my God. I'm going to cry. I might have to leave the room. not had a lot of sleep lately.
That's all right.
Emotional story.
But anyway, and then, obviously, intensive care and life support wasn't particularly fun. But, once you're out of that, it was a case of you just got to look forward. You just got to work out what the rehab is and move on from there, really. I was never told I wouldn't walk again, but I was certainly told that I wouldn't run again. I was told that my physiotherapy career would be over, and I should just get a desk job. and all this kind of stuff. So again, I paid no attention to that at all.
I don't know why they bother telling people these things. Is it to make them more determined to get better and go, I've proved you wrong? Do you think there's a bit of reverse psychology in it, maybe?
Possibly.
Maybe.
Where have we got to with that story?
So it took you like 6 months to... more than that.
So I was in a wheelchair for...
Various surgeries.
Obviously I had all the kind of initial surgery just to stop me dying that night. The pelvic trauma was such that the initial fixation, they put a big frame, like an external frame to hold me in place called an X-fix. But because I was leaking fluid everywhere from these wounds, they had to tear that off. So I had an unstable pelvic fracture for 2 weeks. Because I wasn't safe enough to go back into theatre. I was too unwell for more surgery, and I was too unwell to be transferred to another hospital, so I was just left with an unstable pelvic fracture for 2 weeks until I was medically fit enough to then be transferred to the John Radcliffe in Oxford for specialist surgery. Managed to get transferred over there, and a chap called Peter Warlock, I believe he's retired now, he put my pelvis back together again as best that he could, and it was at that stage I then had the plastic surgery to reconstruct my elbow, and I broke my jaw, but they didn't realise that at the time. It was obviously your jaw hanging off is the least to be worried when you're bleeding out from everywhere, so then have my jaw put back together again at John Radcliffe, obviously rehab from there. So I was in a wheelchair, because obviously if you've got two broken legs and a broken arm, you can't even use crutches. So in a wheelchair for the best part of 6 months, and then crutches for another sort of 6 months or so. But then I was getting problems with some of the metalwork, so I then had the metalwork taken out of my left leg, and that then settled back down again. But my right femur, my right thigh, because of the nature of that fracture, it didn't heal. So it just wasn't healing. So I had more surgery to take some of the, what's called the locking screws out, so the things sort of holding you together, to allow it all just to compress. So that then allowed the bone to heal. But of course, I was now left with a leg that was a lot shorter, and it was also twisted. So I couldn't run. I couldn't even ride a bike. It was not good. So looking at options about what to do about this short leg, obviously what I wanted was to break the leg again and stretch it out.
Obviously.
But went to, I spoke to 7 surgeons. 5 said, don't do it, it won't work. 1 said, I've never done that surgery, but I'll give it a go. And the other one was, I've done this, it might work, we'll try if you want.
Wow.
So I went with him. And that happened to be Peter Warlock again, who was the guy who put my pelvis back together.
Wow. And worked?
Well, to be fair to the people that said it wouldn't work, it kind of didn't, because it didn't heal again. So I then had more surgical bone grafts to get the femur to heal. Mm-hmm. So another 9 months down the line, I've then got a right leg, which is still shorter than it was, but it was longer than it used to be, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Are we talking like an inch or a centimetre?
So I'm probably about a centimetre and a half shorter than my left leg.
Yeah.
My left leg is also shorter at the shin than it used to be, and also a bit twisted, but that's less of a problem. So overall, I'm significantly shorter than I was. And those who know me, I'm not tall at the best time to start with.
But you're here. Do you know what? I've never noticed that you're wonky at all, because you came on the Bridgedale trail running shoot in 2020, and I took loads of photos of you leaping around and running, and I never even noticed. So they did a great job. And you're here, and you won the Summer Spine Race, which is fantastic.
That's right. So yeah, just, long rehab and... I did hydrotherapy, turned into swimming, riding an exercise bike, and then bought a road bike that did turn into triathlon. I still clearly remember the first time I was allowed to then try running again, and I ran for 30 seconds on the treadmill, And it was just amazing. I found my mother in tears. You know, I can run, it's possible.
That's so good. And,
a decade later, 2 decades later, you know, I'm now sort of podiums and all the rest of it. Yeah. So it's a long journey, but it's doable.
Do you think you would have worked hard anyway? Like, you've put in a lot of effort to achieve every win and every podium place that you've got anyway. Do you think this has made you work even more determined? Do you think you would have still got those type of podiums if you hadn't had that accident?
Well, there's the million-dollar question, isn't it? Obviously...
Because you were quite dedicated beforehand, weren't you? You were quite into your fitness and you loved... Yeah. Loads of different sports, karate, like martial arts and running and swimming, climbing trees, everything.
Yeah. So, you know, I was always pushing myself and, you know, I always wanted to kind of explore my limits. So, I think that's obviously a key part of my personality. But has this, you know, driven me further? Yeah, maybe. I think it's too hard to say. The easy answer is yes, of course, it's made me work harder because you realise life is short. And it is, and that's very true. But there's obviously got to be a part of your underpinning personality that drives that as well. It's not as simple as just, if you have an experience like this, then you're going to be, you know, more determined than ever. It's not quite as cut and dry as that.
Yeah. Well, you've made everybody very impressed. Andrea says, you're not the only one going to cry, Claire. So we've all got tissues here. We've got quite a few questions as well. We'll flip forwards now again, to segue again back to the spine race, because we've got a few questions around nutrition, and I know this was the next thing that you talked about in your blog anyway, so it seems good to mention it now. So we have got a question from Hannah Basley. She's Hannah Neal on Facebook, but this is Hannah Basley, who also did the Spine Challenger, and she says she didn't see you. You were at the front. She has a question about nutrition. She said, I found it really difficult to keep fueling over the latter stages of the Challenger, despite lots of varied fuel on me. I think the sleep deprivation probably played a part, and I probably didn't take on enough fluids, so the wheels pretty much fell off by the end. She says, I might have answered my own question. Different sleep strategy, keep taking on fluids, but any tips? And there's also somebody watching live here as well, called David Alonso, and he says he's going to be running his first trail ultra, first 60k, sorry, the Ultra Trail de Chic-Choc, which sounds really cool, and I think you should probably run that in Crocs, like Ultra Trail de Chic-Choc in Croc. He says, any advice, nutrition, shoes, we've covered the shoes, and he says it's in Quebec, in Canada, so 10,000 feet of elevation gain. So yeah, so basically people want to know about nutrition in 100 mile races and any kind of ultra.
You got to test. So in the same way that, you know, I tested lots and lots of different shoes, I tested lots of different nutrition strategies. I mean, nutrition is a, you know, utterly essential part of your preparation and key determinant to your success at running an ultramarathon. One of the main reasons why people fail to finish an ultramarathon is often nausea or GI distress or, you know, inability to eat or drink, and that just ends your race. You know, if you can't get that nutrition on board, then it's game over. So learning what works for you is crucial for that success, and you've got to test it in the type of environment. You know, if you're starting at night time, for example, you've got to work out, will your stomach accept food at 2 o'clock in the morning, because it's not used to doing that, is it? So, you know, you've got to kind of put that into practice. You've got to go and do some night runs and actually train yourself. You can train the stomachs in the same way that you train your heart and your lungs and your muscles. You can train your stomach, and you can train it to be able to take more and more calories. So if you mix up the sort of glucose and fructose mix, you can train it to take on more. So we used to think that we could maybe manage 60 grams of carbs an hour. Well, studies have shown that actually you can take up to 120 grams of carbs an hour if you train yourself for that. Now, that particular study was based on a mountain marathon, so a shorter duration than obviously the ultras that we're talking about. So maybe 120 grams is maybe a little bit more than realistic, but certainly you want to be training yourself to take more than 60 grams an hour. And that just comes with practice, and you can teach your stomach to be able to tolerate more and more food, essentially. Now, where that calorie comes from will vary from individual to individual. So I mentioned Andy Morley, who came in third place. You know, his fueling strategy, a key part of that was a mixed bag of hula hoops. And obviously he had his bacon butties and so on and so forth. I can't tolerate that kind of solids, so mine was mostly drink, gels, supernatural fuel pouches, and a couple of cereal bars. And I had a little bit of saurine at the aid station, and a banana as well. And that was it. Otherwise, it was just drink and gel. So I can't tolerate much in the way of big solid stuff. Mm-hmm. It needs to be very much more digestible. Obviously different ultras will have different amounts of support. So the spine, you basically got one checkpoint for the spine challenger.
Yeah.
There's another couple of extra water. Exactly. Yeah. So you've got to carry a lot. So, you know, trying to then refill with maybe tailwind powders or things like that becomes very, very difficult. So you've got to go with other nutrition options. But of course, a race that has lots and lots of aid stations, where maybe you can, you know, refill with, you know, tailwind sachets or other kind of sports drink sachets, you know, that might be far more doable. Some might be offering, you know, aid stations with good food every, you know, 10K, 10 miles, whatever it might be. So again, you don't need to carry too much with you, and you've got a good variety of stuff. But of course, if there isn't that, then you've got to work out what you can carry. But of course, the more you carry, the heavier pack, and then that starts to impact on, again, your performance, because the energy expenditure of actually carrying all of this food. So that sort of comes into it as well. On a personal level, I mentioned already some supernatural fuel pouches. So I actually did a review for your channel on these pouches. So yes, maybe go back and look
I
at that one.
Try to link to it now.
Yeah,
put a link into it.
And they're brilliant because they are real food, sort of seeds and fruit, and some vegetables and some of them that are blended up. So you're squeezing it out of a pouch. It's basically like baby food. So it's got a bit of texture to it, a little bit of, you can almost chew it, but you don't need to. So something I find is, you know, I prefer to race on just really drink and gels and that really simple, easy to swallow energy, which keeps the energy levels up. But I then get a little bit hungry. My stomach just needs something a little bit solid. And I find those supernatural fuel pouches just fill that gap. They just give me that little bit of solid. But they're not so sort of complicated for my gut to deal with that it causes any GI distress.
And also you can send the packets back to them,
yes,
which is very environmentally friendly. So we like that also, big cycle plus for supernatural pouches. I'll link to them in the film description below.
Yeah. The other thing about them is, because they're real food, they've got bits of fat and bits of protein in as well. So again, it just gives that stomach and a little bit more, gives your body a little bit more than just pure carbohydrate. So again, I like them for that reason. And then, you know, so what I'll do is I'll have one of those pouches maybe every 2 hours, but every 20 to 30 minutes, I'm taking a gel or an energy drink or something else on board. And then maybe every sort of 3 or 4 hours, I'll be taking a more like a cereal bar type thing. So I was using Morton for my other energy. So I was using the Morton drinks at the beginning, and then at the aid station, I've refilled with Morton drink there. And then otherwise it was just the gels and a couple of their bars that they've got as well, just that little bit of extra solid stuff.
Yeah.
That was basically it. So it's going to keep it simple, give yourself a little bit of variety. So again, with the supernatural fuel pouches, I had different flavours. So again, every time I was then using one of those, it was a slightly different flavour. So we just so you don't get that taste fatigue from just taking the same thing all the time. There was one of the guys I saw that did the full spine race, and his nutrition strategy was, I think it was like Haribo M&Ms and tinned peaches or something.
Oh.
That may not be 100% correct, but it was tinned peaches sort of for every kind of checkpoint. If it works, great, but I just think, you're going to get taste fatigue sooner or later. And that's obviously what some people get is, towards the end of the race, you maybe have food with you, but you just can't get it down because you kind of go to look at that gel and just go, I can't take one of those off. Just sick of the flavour or something.
And sometimes you don't know. You don't know sometimes until you actually get to like 80 miles what you're going to need. Like even if you've already done 100 miler before, it could vary from race to race. So maybe take a few little wild cards as well just to go, Percy Pigs, excellent, I'll have one of them.
Liz, who's one of our nutritionists as part of the coaching team, Liz Mahon, her husband was actually running the race as well, Lee. But Liz actually did a really good post on that particular point that you've got your nutrition strategy and you've got your plan. But again, no plan survives first contact with the enemy. Or as Mike Tyson says, everyone's got a plan so you get punched in the face. So you have your nutrition strategy, you have your nutrition plan, but you've got to be prepared for when it goes wrong. So what are you going to have if your body just goes, nah, I don't want to eat that? So you've got to have your emergency kind of treat in your bag. So I had had a couple of Snickers put away so that if, if I'm just going, I just don't want to eat anything like that, I know that I'll always want to have a Snickers. So I just want. It turns out I didn't need to take those on board. But you have your kind of little treat or a little something just for when it all goes wrong and your plan goes out the window.
Yeah, for me that would be a Boost bar. I love a Boost bar.
There you go.
Have them in real life because they're far too sweet. But once I had one on a mountain marathon and boy, was it good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think does that sort of answer the questions there?
You've just got to try it yourself, haven't you? You've got to do your own research on that. That's the answer, basically, isn't it?
But you've got to practice in training. So you've got to go out and, even if you're just going for, an hour and a half run or something, you think, I don't need to take anything on board for that. But an hour and a half run, you could be getting through, 60, 90 grams of carbs there or more. So try that. What's it like to actually, have a meal and go for, and then go out for a run? So, if we're coming through an aid station and we're having, some solid food, and then we're going to leave that aid station and try and run again, well, what's that like? So have your lunch and go straight for your run, or have your dinner and then go straight out the door and learn what that feels like. How long do you have to walk for before your stomach will then allow you to run? How hard can you run, or do you have to really take it slowly? So, one of my rules is, yes, you go to the aid station, you grab your food, but then you walk out of that aid station.
Yeah.
You're having to drink, you're eating your food as you're walking out of that aid station. And then how long do you need to keep walking for before you can then start running again? So know what that is for you. So that, again, you don't then stress your stomach, but you've got to train it.
You've got to practice it and train it. We have a lot of food chat coming in on the live chat.
That's good.
Hannah says she loves the idea of the tin peaches at the Craven Tri Club aid station on the spine race.
I had rice pudding. I forgot. Yes, I did have rice pudding.
Yeah, slips down really easily, doesn't it?
Exactly.
And Con Lethbury says his emergency food is a blueberry muffin, which sounds really nice. I haven't had my dinner, so I'm now feeling very, very hungry. Oh, and Hannah also says, for anyone who's new to watching this and joining us live, Hannah has done the Summer Spine Challenger at the same time as Tim did this year, back in June. And she said, the thing that saved me was a double scoop of ice cream in Horton in Ribblesdale. That sounds lovely, because it was quite a warm day, wasn't it?
It was very, very warm.
Yeah, and there is a question. I know it's really warm now as well, so it's really relevant right now if we just quickly cover running in the heat, because I've got a question from STO who says, hello, great channel. Thanks, definitely going to answer your question. Do you have any advice on running in the high temperatures? I personally don't feel very motivated to do so. Thank you in advance.
I actually put a post out about that. I think I linked to it on Instagram a couple of days ago. And there's some stuff on my website about that.
Yeah. I mean, what's your Instagram handle? Just so people can look that up.
HP3.
Okay. Cool.
So, as I've just been talking about nutrition, you can train yourself to cope with the heat better. So actually, that's something I didn't put in my blog, actually, if anybody that's read the blog. The risk was it was going to be a very hot day. I mean, it was warm, but it wasn't quite as hot as it could have been. So in preparation for the race itself, I'd actually been doing a bit of heat acclimatization in terms of sitting in a hot bath for 20 minutes after going for a run. Obviously, if you've got access to a sauna, then brilliant. If you've got access to a heat chamber and you can go running in a heat chamber, then brilliant. If anybody's been following athletes' preparation for Badwater, what's happening now, you know, they've been running on treadmills with the heaters on full blast and things like that.
Sounds
so
horrendous.
You can condition yourself to tolerate the heat better. But then it's about having, again, the right kit. So what clothing is going to work for you in the heat? So I'll give you another example. Joe, who was running with us, Joe, who came in fourth, he's got a full sleeve tattoo, a dark black tattoo. He needs to wear a long sleeve shirt to cover that. Otherwise, in the heat, the sun warms up his tattoo.
Really? That's incredible.
So, you know, it's even just thinking about things like that, you know, the night before the race, in my kit bag, I had three different hats, depending on what the weather was going to be. Mm-hmm. So, you know, think about all these type of things, about your clothing and your kit. When you're actually out there, obviously hydration is a key factor, making sure that you're drinking enough and taking on salts if you need to. So again, I've got a partnership with Precision Hydration, or Precision Fuel and Hydration as they're now called. So getting those electrolytes on board. You know, I got dehydrated mid-race. Those who know the race, as you're approaching sort of Gary's unofficial checkpoint, the Craven Energy checkpoint, that section before there, I'd run out of fluids. I missed a stream refill, and I got dehydrated. But I managed to salvage that with refilling Craven Energy and getting some salts back on board, and then making sure I refilled again when I went through Thornton and Craven, and so on and so forth. So yeah, getting your hydration right, obviously. And then it's about, you know, managing yourself in the heat itself. So if you need to cool yourself down, you know, the instinct is just try and pour water on your face or on your head. But all that does is just tricks your brain into thinking that you're cooler than you are. It doesn't actually cool your core temperature. So the best way to cool your core temperature is obviously cool your blood. So a good access point for that is your wrists, your forearms, because you've got two arteries and two veins with very little fat and skin in between them and the outside. So if you cool your forearms, so plunge them into water or pour water on them and let that evaporate off, that will draw more heat out, obviously, of your blood and therefore your core, and you can cool yourself down better that way. So yeah, in the race itself, when I was passing any streams, I'll be plunging my forearms into the water. I had arm warmers on, so sort of sleeves that I'd sort of pulled out over my wrist. I would wet them, get them sopping wet, have them over my forearms, so as they were then evaporating, that was then drawing off heat and keeping me cool.
Oh, and like so you could put a buff around as well. Like if you're too hot to wear your buff, put it around your wrist and dip it in.
That's exactly that. So if you only put it on your head, you'll trick yourself into thinking you're cooler than you really are. And then you risk actually pushing harder and actually pushing your temperature up too high.
Oh, that's interesting. I've recently, if I run, I go early in the day at the moment. And yesterday I ran 9 miles, but at 7 miles there was, we planned to hit a river at 7 miles. Because 2 miles you can sort of run back without chafing, can't you? So I just got in the river with all of my clothes on and just swam up and down a bit. And then I was like cold to the bones. And then it took me like all day to warm up again. And I went swimming this morning as well for about an hour in the river. And I was cold like all day because my bones were cold. And that's been wonderful. So I wonder if that's that is kind of extreme. You can't do that on a race, but does that is that, am I just tricking myself there, or is that like full core lowering?
Well, that's it. You're cooling yourself right down, and obviously, you know, when we look at other sports where maybe you've got more access to support crews. So if anybody's watching Western States the other week, where obviously athletes have got support crews with them at different points, you know, they're using ice, you know, ice wraps, you know, around their neck, head, back, arms, you know, you name it, using that to obviously then cool that core temperature down. Other sports, you know, maybe Olympic type sports, you know, they'll be using cooling vests, you know, actually putting on an ice vest to pour that cool that temperature right down again. The forearm trick I learned from it was a military researcher. They were looking at his whole career was essentially taking Royal Marines and putting them either in very hot or very cool condition, very cold conditions, and working out how to break them and then how to not break them. That was his career.
Wow.
But he then started working with British Cycling, and that was one of the things that they sort of took over, was working with cyclists in the velodrome when it got very, very hot, and they would sit down in these essentially like garden chairs with little troughs for the arms to cool the forearms. And then they could get back on the bike again and perform well.
Great. Okay, so forearms it is then, everybody. Cool our forearms down. So I hope that helped you, STO, and anyone else who's running in the heat at the moment. Hannah says...
What was the other question, though? Was there something else?
Hannah said the best way to learn is by just doing things like the spine race. She says there's so many things she'll do differently next time. So we are going to hook up with Hannah, actually. Hopefully she's got some time in a couple of weeks' time, because I want to find out all those things that she's going to do differently.
Yeah, okay.
And the other question we've had another one come in. I was about to ask you about the mental preparation, so this sort of ties in quite nicely, actually. So David Alonso says, where do you find the motivation during the bad moments, you know, like when you ran out of when you missed that water fill up, and you said in your blog you had a bit of a low moment at that point. How do you get through stuff like that personally, and what do you recommend for all of us?
So is actions on. So again, it's the military coming through, which is, you know, you basically plan for every eventuality.
Yeah.
And you have a plan for when that crops up.
Okay.
So, in terms of when I ran out of water at that point there, well, the plan was, right, hold on, I haven't got a chance to refill here, so what am I need to do? I need to minimise how much I'm sweating, so I need to back off the pace a little bit. I need to ration the water that I have got to get me to that next point, rather than you know, running out completely, getting very dry mouth, and then sort of knocking yourself from there. Hold the water in your mouth for that little bit longer. Don't just swallow it instantly, so you trick the brain into thinking that you're getting more water than you really are. So again, keep the brain happy. But you know, you have a plan for that. You know, that eventuality happen. You know, I had a plan. Anything you could imagine that was going wrong, I had a plan that I would then put into place. It's again, so that there's no thinking involved. It's all automatic. So, you know, something goes wrong, you don't panic, you don't fuss, you don't stress. It just goes, okay, that's happened, I do this. Okay, that's happened, I do this.
Mm-hmm.
And just having that, it just takes away all that mental stress, because having to think about stuff uses up energy.
What if something happens that you hadn't ever thought about? Like, I can't really think of anything, like aliens land or something like that. Where, like, how do you know that you thought of absolutely everything?
Again, can you ever think of everything? No, probably not. But because you've gone through those processes of, well, if this happens, I'm going to do this, this, or this. If something does crop up, it's a case of, well, we'll just stop, pause, let's work out a solution, let's not panic, let's not go off the rails here, let's just stop, pause. So again, you know, if you haven't got a lot of experience, if it's your first ultra marathon, the truth of the matter is something is going to go wrong. If you do something of that duration, something is going to go wrong. It's how you react to it, it's how you deal with those things going wrong, which will determine your success. Mm-hmm. If something goes wrong and you panic and you throw your toys out the pram and you haven't, you know, then it might be hard to get going again. But it's all right to just stop, have a little cry, sort yourself out, and then work out your plan of action to move forward, and then you just keep moving forward. So I think it's about practicing and working through all of those different scenarios, working out what's within your control and what's with, you know, outside of your control. So some things might go wrong that are completely outside of your control. Well, there's no point getting stressed about that. You're then just going to deal with the situation in front of you. And you mentioned at the beginning there that the training bit was kind of the last thing I talked about in that blog, because it is the least important. It's, you know, if you get all the rest of it right, that's what determines your success. The other sort of mental strategies is about breaking that race down. You know, if you stand on that start line and think, oh my God, the finish is 110 miles away, or 112 as it probably turned out to be, that's a huge distance. The only thing I was thinking about was getting to Sled Pass. And then it was getting to Tallside Res. And so on and so forth. So in my mind, I only had the next maximum sort of 17 mile leg in my head. But that was the longest I had to think for, was 17 miles. Most of them, it was more like 15, 16 miles. That was all I had to think about.
Yeah, chunking. Did you call it chunking?
Chunking. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's
good, it's good word. Chunking.
And you break it into little chunks, manageable chunks.
Yeah.
It's the same with anything. You know, you start any huge project, break it down. Just deal with that little chunk in front of you. Work out the processes to get you through that little section, and then move on to the next one, and then you move on to the next one.
Yeah, that's good advice. Good advice. Yeah.
The other thing you said about the concentration and that type of thing, I think was part of the question there, was music. Some people don't like music, some people do. For me, if I can, I will have music on when I'm running and racing. And certainly when I was away from Andy and I was just on my own, I just had music playing for the rest of it. I'm not entirely sure how the batteries lasted, but they did.
Wow. They're supposed to only last for about 8 hours, aren't they, those AeroFX headphones?
I'm sure I got way over 12 hours out of mine.
Wow, that's incredible. Yeah. You should let them know. Maybe it depends what volume you have it at.
Well, I'm slightly deaf now as well, so So again, I mean, that's one of the things. I just had 90s dance music. Again, it's not my normal listening choice.
Don't lie, Tim. You love a bit of 90s dance.
It's kind of taken me back to my student days and just danced my way down the Pennine Way.
Oh, that's brilliant. I love it in like wonky dancing. So that does lead us actually nicely on to your training, because we've covered getting your shoes right. I don't think we've got enough time to go into like the rest of the gear, but basically practice nutrition, mental preparation we've covered. So now it would be just really good to get in a nutshell how you trained for 100 miles / 110 miles. I've put 100 miles on the film thumbnail, but you know, it attracts the people in, and then we'll break it to them that there's 10 more miles to do.
It was supposed to be 108 miles, but then there were diversions and it was advertised 110, but I think most people's Strava's came out at about 112.
Oh my God. Yeah. Wow, well, extra miles for the money, hey?
So training for it, I think one of the questions I was asked on social media was, you know, what was my weekly mileage, thinking it's going to be something extraordinary. It was probably on average about 50, maybe 60 miles a week.
That's good.
A lot of them were less than that. I think I had maybe one that was a bit more than 60 miles a week, maybe not quite 70. I had the intention of doing more, but just life got in the way. Mm-hmm. So the volume doesn't need to be huge. That's
good
to
know.
Strength training was a key component. So
like
getting
that
at the gym. So I had a big block over the winter where I was in the gym at least twice a week, lifting heavy, proper heavy.
Yeah.
Just getting strong and resilient, getting those tendons strong, getting the bones strong, so I could then tolerate the other stuff later on. And again, in that final block, I was just doing a lot of muscular endurance work. So, you know, I'd just be going in my garage with I've got a big plyo box step thing, some kettlebells, dumbbells, weights vest, stuff like that, and just doing an utter ton of lunges, step ups, squat jumps, that type of thing. Just really building that muscular endurance, because I wasn't able to get into the hills that much. Again, because of, you know, family pressures in terms of looking after the kids and work and things like that, I wasn't actually able to get to the gym to do my normal workouts. But that was enough just to keep me ticking over.
That's amazing.
In terms of the actual sort of running, it's making it as race specific as possible. So luckily I live, as I mentioned, sort of almost on the Pennine Way. It's only about a mile and a half to Capri, maybe 2 miles away. But I would just do a lot of my runs on the Pennine Way. I was going out and doing recces on the route. So just getting conditioned to that, knowing that I could run that pace on that ground, and just dialing in race pace. So a lot of it wasn't fast. You know, I was looking at people around me and they're training for this race, and, you know, they were doing a lot of their runs a lot quicker than me. But they clearly weren't doing it on the actual terrain of the Pennine.
Yeah.
And that's a crucial thing as well.
Yeah. It's good that you live nearby, isn't it? Cause,
Absolutely. It's a blessing.
Yeah.
For something like this. But, you know, if you can't get there, then it's understand the nature of that terrain that you're going to and try and replicate it as best that you can. You know, an example would be a race I've done a couple of times in Gran Canaria, Trans Gran Canaria. That's another brilliant race. But I would replicate the climbs on my treadmill. So I'd work out the elevation, the incline, and replicate that on the treadmill. I'd use some of the technical sections, very rough underfoot. And there's a hill near me with, again, some paths where the rocks are very, very similar to that. And I would just run up and down that, just do reps up and down that, just to simulate what it's going to be like underfoot when I go to Gran Canaria.
You mentioned training blocks as well, which is obviously like a thing that you do if you're if you know about coaching and training properly. I'm interested to know, because you are a coach, do you coach yourself or do you have a coach who is like somebody else in HP3?
No, I coach myself these days. I have been coached by several people in the past. So no, I'm self-coached now, because managing my sort of diaries of, you know, multiple diaries, like you mentioned, I wear a few different hats, it's quite complicated, so I do have to just sort of grab bits of time as and when, and I don't really follow a maybe a traditional training pattern as such. But then I've got other people who, you know, I will go to for that little bit of an outsider's take on things and just help with decision making. So kind of Joe is one example, one of the coaches of the squad. You know, I would run things past him, and he does the same with me. I've got other colleagues, you know, other companies who, again, I would go to for bits of advice as when needed. I coach myself just because my life is that complicated.
Hectic, Oh, cool. And I noticed also that you do some extra things in recovery that I've not done before, and I know it's becoming a bit more trendy, but you use those e-stims things, and a massage gun as well. I think that's really interesting to know, because often you like see all this gadgetry and you just think, oh, that's a total gimmick, I'm just going to do a Joss Naylor and get in the beck, the river, at the end of my run and cool off my legs that way, or have an ice bath. But talk a little bit about how those helped you then.
So the Compex, again, I've got a relationship with Compex.
Is that the that's the like electrical
stimulation,
electrical pulses,
yeah,
thing.
The muscle stims.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic bit of kit. It really, really is. It's passive, so you can do other exercises where you're actually working with the electrical stim. But yeah, I use it a lot for recovery. Because at the end of the day, you do your run, but then, we've all got other busy lives, we're all doing other things. So I'll be coming back and then I'm at my desk and I'm having to then work.
Mm.
And you just let your legs just sit there. But what we really want is just a little bit of that active movement. Just keep those muscles just gently ticking over, keeping that little bit of blood supply and the lymphatic flow going. So using the electrical stim just to give those muscles just that little bit of movement is really, really useful. One of the sort of big determinants for aerobic exercise that we do is about how many capillaries, those small blood vessels that supply your muscles. And obviously, the more of those little blood vessels you have, the more of the oxygen and the nutrients you can get into your muscles for them to actually work. So again, it's really good at the capillarization, actually building these capillaries through those little muscle contractions. And also some of the shear stresses, so pulling the muscles in different directions. So it can be useful for that as well. And again, used it for muscle strengthening. So you mentioned earlier on there about my ankle, and yeah, I've got very little left in terms of ligaments holding my left ankle together. So I'm prone to spraining my ankle. And if you sprained your ankle, one of the problems with that is you then to damage some of those nerves and your ankle doesn't react quick enough to when you start to turn it over. So you can use the electrical stim to give your muscles a really hard, really fast muscle contraction to teach yourself to actually correct that little twist that you might be starting to do. So again, with me, some of my trauma, my damage is that some of the muscles, particularly my right side, don't fire quick enough. They're just a bit sluggish, the nerves just aren't very good anymore. But I can use the electrical stim to really get them firing quickly, and that just kind of gets that ball rolling again. And again, the massage hammer, there's nothing special about it, but it feels good.
Mm-hmm.
It helps relax those muscles. It gives your nervous system a good stimulus to help relax you down and give you some pain relief. So if your muscles are sore and tense, it's going to be uncomfortable to function day to day or go for your next run or do your next training session. You use a massage gun, you get rid of that pain, the vibrations just trick your brain, you ease a lot of that muscle tension, and you feel better. If you feel better, you train better. You train better, you can go on and perform better. So, I mean, there's nothing magical about these things, but they work and they're good.
Cool.
So, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's really interesting. I think I might order a couple in to test then, because it would be really interesting to see how they work. And
yeah, no worries. Yeah. I'll set you up. I can set you up with that.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Done deal. So that's training. That's recovery. I do have one more question for you before we ask you what's next. Who inspires you? Like, because I'm looking at you and I'm really inspired. I'm just thinking, wow, Tim's amazing. Maybe I could run 100 miles one day. I haven't even been in a car crash, so I should be fine. Who inspires you?
I'm not one for sort of trying to compare with other people. There's a few people who I certainly look up to in terms of the ultra running. And I think sort of big one up there would be Courtney DeWalter.
Cool.
I just think her sort of mental attitude to racing, just going out there and having fun, and the way that she, talks about, welcoming that pain cave and just going straight into it and getting on with it, I think it's just brilliant. So I think she's certainly an inspiration that I think all of us can look towards as well. And she's obviously, she's got a good background, but when she first started out in this game, she was still working full time as a teacher, and it's just kind of rolled from there. So I think that's certainly one person I would look up to. But I work with a lot of novice and beginner athletes, and I often look up to what people are doing at maybe the other end of the experience spectrum and you know, other end of the field, and all the challenges that we all have to deal with. But you know, some people are juggling, you know, many, many different time and pressure challenges. So I wouldn't necessarily kind of put any one, I mentioned Courtney there, but I don't really put many other people on a pedestal. Yeah. It's a tricky one, really.
I think she's a really good one.
I pick bits of everybody.
Yeah.
So there's never kind of one person. I just go, oh, I want to be like you.
Yeah.
I cherry pick because I want to, you know, bits of that.
You draw from lots of sources.
I love Killian Journey's ankle stability, but that's never happened. He's downhill skilled.
Oh my God, yeah, that would be amazing. Yeah, I love Courtney as well because she just appears like really down to earth. Like, I know people use the word humble, but I think humble's a bit like, you know, like a bit humble bragging. I think she's like just, yeah, like you said, she just gets on with it. Mm. Like, she's just like, oh, right, okay, then off we go. Oh, this has happened. Oh, okay, oh, I've got blind. 80 miles into a race and I've gone blind. Oh, I'll just keep going. You know, she's just incredible like that. On the live chat, Andrea says, lots of very interesting training and recovery info. Thank you. So she's enjoying that. Petra Alma also says that she swears by her massage gun. She says it really speeds up recovery, so definitely go get one of them as well. Yeah. That's basically all the questions I had to ask you about the ultra running and the training and the spine race. So unless there's anything you wanted to add, I do have just one last question for you, Tim.
I don't think so. We've gone over our time by quite a bit.
Yeah, we have.
My voice has lasted longer than I thought it was going to.
You've done really, really well. It's just been so interesting chatting to you. I couldn't leave out any of the questions. Basically, I wanted to know what's next for you in terms of the rest of 2022, or maybe even some plans for 2023 that you've got. And I'm just thinking, like, your story's incredible. Have you ever considered writing a book about, like, your experiences? And, you know, I think it would be an amazing read.
It has been mentioned. Several people have said I should
help you if you want. If you, you know, I'll help you with the editing thing.
Yeah, maybe you can be my ghostwriter.
I don't think you need a ghostwriter, but you know, like, if you need a bit of zing adding to it, or it cutting down, you always write, like, I find I always write really long.
Yeah, it has been mentioned. Maybe that's something for retirement. I don't know. Maybe I should do it sooner. We'll see. I suppose that's sort of typical Brit of, I don't really kind of talk about that too much, the accident side of things. I kind of parked that a little bit, but you know, there's so many people keep pushing me to kind of use that a bit more, and I find it sort of slightly uncomfortable, this whole sort of, it's inspiring, but
yeah, like, you don't want to put yourself in the limelight and be like, oh, look at me, I did this. I don't see it like that, though. I see it as a story that could help people, like, it would be inspirational to them, and it would, I think it would be very helpful. And because of your career as a coach and a physio, you would obviously be putting loads of helpful stuff in there as well as you went along the way. So I don't think it would be a look at me book. I think it would be here's some help book. That's how I see it.
Let's talk more.
Yeah, that'd be great. You should talk to him.
What's next? I've got Lakes in a Day, so that's the 50 miler from the top of the lakes down to the bottom. So a call back to Cartmel. So that's in October. I'm toying with the idea of doing another race this season, but obviously, I mentioned at the start, I'm just getting over COVID at the moment, so I've ended up having a longer recovery after this race than I really anticipated. And then I've got sort of family holiday coming up and things like that, so it might be that I just focus maybe on next year and just do Lakes in a Day for a bit of fun with, again, I've got a few of the team coming over, and one of the guys coming over from Sweden to race it as well, so it might just be a bit more of a kind of team outing rather than a full-on race. We'll see how the recovery after COVID goes. I'm not gonna rush that recovery and risk any longer term stuff.
Yeah.
And then next year, I've got a few ideas in my head in terms of races. But again, I need to kind of compare diaries and work out what's going to fit. One project I've just started working on though is there's a group of us hopefully going to go and run the Hope Route.
Oh,
so
brilliant.
From Zermatt to Chamonix.
Yeah.
Do that over maybe 5 days, try and push it into 5 days.
Lovely.
So that would be a good mountain adventure if I can pull that one off.
Yeah, that sounds wonderful. Yeah, I'd love to do some more stuff like that, you know, like UTMB over 6 days and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, so you're not just like gunning it and not looking at the views all the time.
Well, talked about when you and I first did some stuff together, you were supposed to be going out and actually doing UTMB over
And then I think COVID happened, and then I got pregnant.
Yeah.
But I think we're just going to have one, because otherwise it's going to really mess up my running. So yeah, I might be back in action. You know, like I'm building up. I'm doing a couple of half marathons, so building up for building up the distance again.
Good stuff.
Yeah, but that sounds exciting, Bernese Overland. Yeah. Maybe you'll write the book in a couple of years when you've done like a few more big things to write about. Yeah.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, well, it's been really great to chat to you tonight, Tim.
Yeah, good to
And everyone, we've had loads of people watching live and asking questions. It's been really fun. Thank you to everybody on the live broadcast. And if you've got any other questions for Tim, just type them in the comments below. So where can people follow you on your adventures and ask you about your coaching and physio?
Yeah, so I kind of keep the social stuff on Instagram. So Tim Piggott, HP3. So PIGOTT, spelling Piggott. So you'll find me on Instagram there. And then there's a team Instagram as well, which is at Team HP3, if you want to follow and see what some of the athletes are up to in our squad. Website is hp-3.co.uk. So again, various resources on there and things like that that can maybe sort of help you. Those are the kind of places you'll find me. I have got Twitter, but I don't really use Twitter.
Yeah, awesome. Okay, well, I'm sure everybody's going to be checking out the blog. Definitely check out the resources tab and then the blog, and then scroll down for Tim's amazing race preparation and during race blog post there, because that was a really interesting read. And it links to the backstory as well with the car crash and the recovery. So, yes. Okay, well, thanks so much, Tim. Congratulations on winning the summer spine
race. Good to catch up. Good to see you again.
Yeah, and we shall talk soon, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. Night, everybody.
Cheers. Thanks for chatting.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great, too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.